Hello, mates. Another There to Dive. I literally just got back from London, England. That's my best one. I was working on it while I was over there, Tad Potters. Just got back from England. PJ, what a start to the season, huh?
It does not get much better than that.
It doesn't. After that first game, it was buzzing.
I didn't think it would. I thought the rest of the week was going to be dull after that because that's normally how it typically goes. But I think 31 goals in 10 games.
Is that what it was?
I think that's what the total was. That's
holy cow.
That's a pretty good way to start the season.
It was funny. After the first game, we were thinking that. So we were at the Emirates. We kick off the season in spectacular fashion. That was actually my first time at the Emirates. What a beautiful ground. I mean, that field. I don't get the urge much anymore. I was saying this to Lee Dixon. We were standing there on the sideline. I don't really feel the urge or miss it and feel nostalgic and want to get back out there and want to play in a game, want to, you know, be under the lights or in the locker room. But when you see that Emirates pitch that has not one blade of grass out of place, I mean, it's kind of like my hair, you just want to get out there. And, we were treated on day one, and it didn't let up. Didn't let up the whole weekend. So, incredible start. All sorts of storylines. I mean, this is a tough tad pod. We've struggled to pick out the three things that we want to talk about. I mean, Wayne Rooney goes back to Everton, scores in his debut. And that knee slide, we were sitting there. We've got a little mini Winnebago at the stadium. That's kind of our holding ground where we, you know, have food and tea and get ready and I fix my hair, and we've got a TV there where we can watch some of the games, and we saw Rooney's knee slide after he scored that goal in his face. I mean, he looked like that was a World Cup winning goal. Like nothing has been as important in his career as the goal he just scored, right?
Definitely. I mean, you know what's interesting is you actually, I think you did a little telestration piece before the match
on
his goal that he scored against Arsenal, his first Premier League
back
goal
in like 2002 or something.
2002,
like
he was 16 years old.
Oh man!
And if you put the celebration side by side, they almost look identical. It's crazy. It's kind of like he was a reborn, you know, 16-year-old kid just playing for his
boyhood club
again. Someone's
got to do that. So maybe, if there's an editor listening, Tad Potter. If there's a Tad Potter out there that can do a meme, we need a side-by-side comparison.
I think there's been some photos posted out there.
He looked younger, did he not? We were debating that when he walked out there.
He definitely looked fitter. He was the way, not just the header on the goal, but the run-up to it, too. This looks like Wayne Rooney of old that we're used to seeing.
So, yeah, we're not going to get into that today, even though that deserves to be talked about. Huddersfield, what a start to their campaign. Burnley, what a start to their campaign. We're going to get into that, but on the other side. What else? I mean, John Joe Shelby being a moron.
Yeah, big wins for Man City and Spurs, but we kind of, you know, nothing surprising out of that.
We were in Brighton. We were at the Amex. What a beautiful stadium. And a remarkable story. If you're not familiar with the Brighton story, go on YouTube or, you know, Google it. There are these amazing documentaries, these wonderful little stories about what they've been through and how they almost dropped completely out of existence. They sold their stadium. They were traveling 60 or 70 miles to play their home games at one point. Arlo White, actually, go follow him if you don't, or go check out his Twitter feed. He actually tweeted out a few days ago the link to that. But endless. So many cool stories, so many amazing storylines, and they will continue through the season. Before we get into the business and the three that we picked out, we do a fun thing on the Tad Pod. If you're listening and you're a regular listener, you know what I'm talking about. If you're a new time listener, we like to have fun on the reviews. So the reviews are important because, and I still, maybe I should figure out why it's important because I always say that I have no idea why this works, but the reviews help bump us up. So when you search,
it helps the rating. It just kind of helps gain attention for the show basically, which helps new fans find the show.
It makes us look cool.
So, yeah.
Even if it's a bad rating.
Exactly.
So
it's an Apple podcast. They like seeing, you know, all the, I guess, you know, seeing a podcast that's busy with ratings and things like that. That's getting a lot of attention. It just helps.
So do it. That. So PJ's right. Do it. And that's finally an explanation of why. Last season, we did a fun thing with the reviews where we had you sneak in your favorite movie reference or movie quote. This season, we've been thinking about it. We've been throwing back some ideas. This is what we've come up with. So we all have that soccer moment, you know, when you fell in love, you know, that first time story of it doesn't have to be your first memory, but your first real memory that when you get chills, you think back to this moment. I mean, I've got so many. But if I were to like throw some out that are immediately coming to my head, Roberto Carlos's free kick against France. Yeah. I mean, Barthez just standing there watching that thing head towards the corner flag and come in. Something like that. So what we want you to do now is throw in a review and then throw one of your magic soccer moments in there, the moment that gives you chills. And when we start every podcast, we'll read a few of our favorite. All right. All right, PJ, let's get down to it.
Ready?
So here's the three topics that we got this week. Liverpool. What is going on at Liverpool? The latest Coutinho drama, not the most ideal start to their campaign on or off the field. So we'll get into that. Manchester United. The fear factor felt like it was back at Old Trafford. I mean, what a performance that was. One of the best performances, we were talking about this afterwards, since Sir Alex Ferguson left. Yeah, I mean, you really have to say that.
I think since 2006, their biggest win.
Yeah, most dominant. I mean, if you're getting as Robbie Musto says, data and fact. If you're going to go data and fact,
yeah.
Best performance since 2006, data and fact. That. But, oh, man, that felt like Manchester United. Mm-hmm. You know, that felt big. But first, Chelsea. What is going on at Chelsea Football Club, PJ? And let me just pat myself on the back for a second and say I did, and go back and listen to the preview podcast, guys, if you haven't listened to it yet, and hear the things that I got right and the things that I got remarkably wrong, and we'll go through all of them. But one of the things that I said was I was worried about Chelsea. Mm-hmm. I was worried that this team could relapse into the funk that we saw, the just discombobulated, disconnected disbelief of that terrible title slump that they had after they went and won the title. Afterwards, with Jose Mourinho and everything just blew up, I just sensed that nowhere near the level of that capitulation, of that just remarkable blow up. But I just sensed it wasn't right behind the scenes. And some of the things that we were hearing, you know, Antonio Conte was saying, I don't want to. He was even referencing the Jose Mourinho era, saying, I don't want to have a Jose Mourinho blow up. I don't want to have a Mourinho-like season with this squad. Almost sort of in a prescient way, where he sensed that the focus wasn't there, the players weren't there. They haven't spent a lot in the transfer window. The signings that they have brought in, Morata didn't start, and Bakayoko isn't fit. Rudiger started. So We went and looked. I remember when the game started, we got the team sheets an hour beforehand. We went and looked at the bench. So one of them on the field, 20-year-old Boga, got his Premier League debut, yep. Which is great. And we even said that before the game. It's wonderful to see these young players getting their opportunity, mm-hmm. especially since Chelsea typically loan out all these guys, yep. and send them all over the place.
Especially under Mourinho, who was very reluctant to bring in young guys in their debuts.
So at the risk of sounding like hypocrites, look at the inexperience in the side. Christensen, who had to come into the game because of the mayhem at the beginning of that one. Gary Cahill getting a red card. 21 years old. Kennedy, 21 years old. Musonda, 20. Kyle Scott, 19. Tomori, 19. I mean, this is the reigning champions. This is Chelsea. They want to defend a title. This is Antonio Conte, who won three titles in a row with Juventus. Not a great start to the campaign. Now, obviously, injuries. Eden Hazard still coming back from that ankle injury. Bakayoko, as I just said, coming back from a knee injury.
Pedro's injured.
You know, getting
Moses
injured in preseason.
Moses was unavailable too.
Yeah. So mitigating circumstances are they're getting some guys back, right? But still, so light. They still haven't done enough business in the transfer window. The window's still open for another couple weeks. That result, in a weird way, might help them because it's going to wake up the front office. It's going to wake up the men upstairs. Abramovich will definitely see that they should have spent a little bit more. And what we're hearing now is £150 million is being prepared to go and remedy that immediately. Some names are being thrown out, Oxlade-Chamberlain and the like. But they need to go spend. They need to strengthen this squad. But that's only one issue that needs to be addressed.
Yeah. I mean, but it is a major issue because the thing that baffles me is we've seen other clubs go out and do their business early. Man City made their moves early. Manchester United made some moves early. So how much of this is bad luck with the injuries they've had with some of the key players and new signings, and how much of it is this bad preparation? You would think a club like Chelsea would know it's best to get your business done in the summer in June and July and not try and worry about this.
None of it's bad luck. None of it's bad luck. Yeah, I mean, injuries are bad luck. But when you're Chelsea, you need to have depth. And Antonio Conte didn't have to rotate his squad a lot last year. So that's one part luck, another part great preparation. The guys were fit and he kept them healthy. I mean, through an entire campaign, obviously something's going good at Chelsea because that happened with Jose Mourinho as well. The medical staff there is obviously excellent because they don't run into this very often. So, yeah, you could say that's bad luck. But against Burnley, who only won one game away from Turf Moor last year, you should not be losing the game in the fashion that they lost it. That has nothing to do with injuries. They could put out an entire second squad, no disrespect to Burnley. They could put out an entire second. Everyone always says that, right? Like, no disrespect to Burnley. Now I'm getting ready to say something incredibly disrespectful. They shouldn't lose a game like that. It was about lack of focus. It was about lack of organization. It was about lack of effort. It was about everything they didn't show last year. It was in their campaign. This is obviously post-Arsenal debacle, right? Because we saw at the beginning of last season Chelsea with some cracks, Chelsea looking disorganized, Chelsea struggling in a back four, and then all of a sudden they get hammered by Arsenal. And we don't see any of that. They exercise their demons. Conte goes to a back three that he wanted to do all along. But we were even saying David Luiz looked like he was out of his mind. He was yelling at everyone. There was a moment between him and Courtois where Courtois didn't come out to get a ball, where they screamed at each other. It looked, you know what it reminded me of? It reminded me of the sort of the disconnect and disgruntled demonstration we saw in the campaign when Jose Mourinho lost control of things. And it just reminds me of one thing. An interesting story came out. Diego Costa is in Brazil. He's back at his family house. I think it was a Daily Mail reporter, maybe. Yep. Jumps on a plane. Got to give this guy credit. Finds his home, which is, by the way, in a pretty remote town in Brazil. Mm-hmm. Knocks on the door.
Unannounced.
And Diego Costa answers it and welcomes him in and does the most amazing exclusive interview. If you haven't seen it yet, go check it out.
While he's watching the Chelsea match.
While he's watching the game. I mean, it was like a perfect scenario for a reporter, a dream exclusive. So Diego Costa, back in January, rewind to last season, there was a training ground bust-up, supposedly a report that because his head was turned by China and he got in a fight with the fitness coach, Conte came over, just immediately put his influence on that, put his foot down, took him out of the side, but kind of lied to us in public and said, no big deal, nothing to see here.
He's
got
a back injury,
one of those good old back injuries. I thought at the time, even though I figured he wasn't being honest with us, dealt with it so well because that never became an issue. They handled it. They nipped it in the bud. He played the rest of the year, and he was excellent. Now we find out in the offseason he tweeted or texted him and said, you're no longer needed. We no longer want you. And forget what Diego Costa's done, the type of guy he is, the contentious guy he is. He's loved in that locker room. I've asked around. I've got some people that are in the know around there. He's loved by a lot of people in that locker room. He's almost like the jester. You know, he has a lot of jokes. Everyone loves him. He's enigmatic. He has charisma, and everyone loves him. What Antonio Conte did to him was disrespectful. And this is a long way to get to my point of, what does that feel like? It feels like the doctor, Ivan Caniero, Jose Mourinho started that campaign by disrespecting someone beloved in that locker room. And it began this long, drawn-out process of everything falling apart. That just setting the wrong tone early on in the season. And I just wonder, and I put this out on Twitter today, I just wonder if that's going to set a bad tone in that locker room. And now we have this weird scenario of, similar to the Eva Caniero situation, a legal issue where are they in breach of contract by saying he can't play anymore? Is there going to be a lawsuit to try to get him to Atletico Madrid? Now, supposedly, the latest report is they're telling him, get back here. Get back and start training with us. Which, by the way, I think that would be great if they can convince him to come back on board. Remember, this happened with Tevez.
I was going to say that's the situation it reminds me a lot of.
Right?
Yep.
And Tevez, he didn't want to warm up. I think it was Champions League against Bayern Munich. Maybe. Mm-hmm. He left. He went home. Mancini didn't want him, and they coaxed him back and smoothed it over, and everything was good.
And he was huge in them winning the title that year. He came in back in February or March, I believe.
Yeah, totally.
So,
and Diego Costa,
no reason
you know, Morata didn't start. He did come on. I thought he was excellent, mm-hmm. you know, and it could take time
that's
for him.
That's probably the one positive from that match for them. Yeah.
So it's just, it couldn't have been a worse start. Fabregas, red card. Cahill, red card. Now they're light in a midfield that Bakayoko's not ready for, that they sold Matic from, which, when we get on to Manchester United, is going to make this sound like the most ridiculous move in the summer transfer window, to let him go. Not only let him go, but let him go to a rival. So all is not well at Stamford Bridge. All is not well with the Blues. All is not well for Chelsea, and they need to turn things around and turn around fast.
Quick thought, they play Spurs this weekend. Any quick prediction you want to make for that match?
You could only say, based on how Spurs started the campaign, which they're another storyline we're not getting to because they did the business pretty easily against Newcastle, Spurs should absolutely thrash them based on the way they performed in the first game. If they make mental errors, if they struggle with intensity, Spurs is going to steamroll them.
Oh, yeah, they'll punish him.
So I'm a bit concerned. As I said before the campaign started, I said I was concerned about Chelsea. I got a couple of predictions very wrong based on the first game, but this wasn't one of them. One prediction I did get very wrong based on the first game was I was not high on Manchester United coming into the season. I had them in the top four. PJ, I said they're going to improve, right? They're going to be better than last year. But I think I cited the 24-point gap, some listless and languid home performances at Old Trafford, drawing the most games ever in the Premier League era in that beautiful stadium in the Theatre of Dreams. Not only drawing them, but just drawing them without really looking like they were ever going to win any of those games. So I thought they had a lot of ground to make up. I was and still remain high on Lukaku and Matic as being great signings, which those are two of the reasons that they're going to improve this year. But they were the best team of the opening weekend. That was the best performance of the opening weekend by far. And no need to handicap it with West Ham. You know, they struggled last year. They didn't really show a lot of ambition moving forward. They sat deep. They were bunkered. They were missing a lot of guys. Forget it. They were never in that game. They had one great opportunity at the end of the first half, right before the first half whistle was blown, where De Gea had to make a save with a ball hit right at him. I think they hit the bar in the second half, but they were never in this game.
Yeah. And it's not, like you said, it's not just maybe just a few guys playing well. It seemed like the whole team just looked great. I mean, in attack, Lukaku looked good. I thought Rashford, Mata, Mkhitaryan and all were helping create. Pogba looked like he was finally more free. Matic, you said you're going to get into him. I mean, people are praising him for his man of the match performance all around. I mean, it just looked like a complete, you know, all around team performance of domination over West Ham.
And we'll talk individuals in a moment, but let's give Jose Mourinho a lot of credit here. The way he set up his team for that game and how they played, many people, and I'm in that camp, didn't think that he was going to get out of this group a performance like that and wasn't going to be capable of getting a performance out of that, out of this group like that. Now, the question will be, how sustainable is it? Can it happen? Does he, in big games, expect him to be a bit more pragmatic? I don't expect to see sort of Mata, Mkhitaryan in the same team if they're playing Chelsea or playing Spurs and whatnot. But you know, that's his strategy in big games. I don't like it, but it's hard to criticize him for it because he's always been like that and he wins titles that way. But he set him up in a 4-2-3-1 that was a bit unbalanced with Mata and Mkhitaryan sharing a playmaking responsibility off the right. No one was really playing right wing in this lineup. Valencia was given that channel basically to his own. On the left, Rashford was playing very wide, and I know because Lee Dixon and I were sitting in the seats right next to the West Ham bench, about 20 yards from Rashford. We could almost reach out and grab his jersey. You know, that old saying, get chalk on your boots. He had tons of chalk on his boots. And so Manchester United were basically two different teams with the way Mourinho set them up. They were very direct with a lot of pace off of the left, and they were very intricate and unpredictable and small and crafty off of the right. And it made them so difficult to handle. So I loved, and I said this before the game, I loved his team selection in a couple areas. One is, I was worried for Rashford that it was going to be Lukaku or Rashford, and Rashford staying at Manchester United was going to be a big mistake. We spoke to Thierry Henry before the game. He came over to talk with Lee and I beforehand and just had so many incredible thoughts about Lukaku, who he's worked with Belgium. The challenges for Lukaku at a big club now, you know, some of the areas he needs to improve, holding the ball up, being a little more sophisticated in scenarios where they have a lot of possession against teams that are bunkered in. But praised him, had a lot of wonderful things to say about him, and ultimately thought Lukaku was going to come good at Manchester United. But he offered a little worry about Rashford, and he said, I worry that Rashford, if he's not given opportunities, but opportunities at the striker position, he said, Michael Owen might not have ever happened if he wasn't given opportunities in the striker role, because Owen was played wide, whether it be Fowler or other players that were in that role, Fowler being the biggest one he was fighting against. If Owen wasn't given reps in the striker role, he never would have became the player that he became. And Thierry Henry said, I worry with Rashford, if he plays too much off the left, we're not going to see what he's capable of. He's not going to be able to achieve his full potential, because he considers him to be a striker first and foremost. But I just love that it's not a Lukaku or Rashford. It's an Andor. So he'll get his opportunities at striker. You know, they have plenty of different competitions they're going to be in, Champions League, two domestic cups and whatnot. But I love that he was in the first lineup that he started instead of Lingard or even Fellaini to put, you know, a big, powerful presence in there. He played Rashford in the first game and was rewarded for it. He set up that first goal in a beautiful transition.
It's what I was going to say. It's interesting that Thierry Henry said that, because he started his career as more
off
of a winger
left.
Too.
Yeah.
Exactly, like Rashford. And so you think even though I agree, I'd love to see Rashford play as the main striker more often. It's not going to happen that much with Lukaku, you'd think. But you would have to think when someone like Henry did that, it made him a better player overall when he did transition into that striker role,
yeah.
Better all around. So maybe this is part of the growing process for Rashford in terms of when he does become the main man, whether it's Man United or somewhere else, because who knows? I mean, Lukaku's not an old guy. He's a young guy, too.
Yeah.
So
he can play a lot of games.
He's probably going to be there a while. So yeah. It will be interesting to see how he juggles the two of them if he tries to play Rashford at all. But
yeah.
I just think that that's not a bad thing if he's playing out on the wing and he's going to become a better all-around player.
That's a really interesting point, about Thierry Henry playing off the left.
I was going to say real quick, if you don't, just with Henry, if you want to get into Lukaku's interview with you guys at the end of the, after the match was over, I believe Lukaku named a bunch of the strikers that he's either played with.
And the mentors.
Oh, and he brought up Henry at the end. I think he said that's the one he's learned the most from so far. And he brought up, he had other guys like Drogba. I'm trying to think who else.
God, did he go through?
It was all the players he's played
with. Anelka.
Samuel Eto'o was there. Everton when he first came over. So,
Insane. He's been the understudy for some of the best strikers the game's ever seen. And Thierry Henry is the latest. Not only probably watching him growing up, but more importantly, having him with the Belgian national team. Thierry Henry is brought in by Roberto Martinez to help out with the strikers. So let's move that on to Lukaku. Holy cow. Ideal, perfect scenario debut for Manchester United. Here's where he's going to help Manchester United. Where they struggled last year is against West Ham's. They struggled against teams that bunkered in, that were complacent, sitting back without the ball, and were going to look to counterattack on Manchester United. So this is going to lead me into Matic, but start with Lukaku. So Lukaku helped out because he's powerful. Unlike Zlatan Ibrahimovic, he's a presence in the box. When you play a team that's bunkered in, you get channeled wide. They sit centrally and force you into wide positions, and then they just say, get it into the box. We like our chances dealing with early service and low percentage shots. With Zlatan Ibrahimovic, that's a good strategy, because Zlatan's really not known, although he's a big guy, for his aerial presence. You know, he wants to withdraw into those wide channels and create. He wants to get away from closed down passing lanes in the center of the field. Lukaku's going to stay there. He's going to stay there. He's going to muscle. You know, he does like to withdraw from time to time into wide positions, but he stayed in those little areas where there was little space, where it was difficult to find him. So he'll help in those scenarios. He's very good with the few opportunities he gets. He's a clinical finisher. I think Koeman called him the best finisher he's ever seen, which might be a bit hyperbolic, figuring that he's played with Van Basten and others. But where he's going to help is, how did they score their first goal? In transition. You know, Jose Mourinho wants to be a counterattacking team. even with Manchester United, he wants to be a counter-attacking team. Now, they dominated with possession in this game, and they will in many games against teams that sit back against them. But the few opportunities that teams get forward against Manchester United and open themselves up, they are going to be lethal on the counterattack.
The first goal was,
yeah. Rashford slipped it right in for Lukaku, and they didn't have that with Zlatan Ibrahimovic. And as good as Zlatan is and was for Manchester United, and maybe will be, there's talk of him signing a second half of the year contract with them, which we'll get into that in another podcast. They're going to be better with Lukaku. I think they will because of the way they want to play. That moves me on to Matic. So what happens against teams that sit back and bunker? Will you get numbers forward and you expose yourselves to a counterattack? You being a counterattacking team are vulnerable to them wanting to counterattack you. Matic and Pogba are going to be the best midfield combination in the entire Premier League. Now, Conte is looking across probably saying, I can't believe you took away, you know, my soulmate and Matic, because they were excellent together last year. Mm-hmm. And who knows who's going to play with Conte next game because of the issues they have there. But Matic had the best debut, I think, even better than Lukaku's. The best debut of the weekend.
Yeah, most people were giving him man of the match. Yeah,
he was Lukaku excellent. And what it does is it unlocks Pogba. Pogba has not the freedom to be a playmaker, because they did share the defensive responsibilities. They did play in a two. But Pogba was absolutely mesmerizing that game, and it had a lot to do with Matic.
Definitely. Real quick, you kind of hinted at this about this free-flowing style, if they're going to be able to do it against the bigger teams. Will we more likely see against the bigger or tougher opponents someone like Matic and Herrera and Pogba together? And would that slightly change things?
So what's going to happen is Mkhitaryan and Mata, who were excellent in that game, especially Mkhitaryan. He finished the end of last year strong. He had a good preseason. He's going to show Manchester United fans in the league why he was Bundesliga Player of the Year, why Borussia Dortmund fans cried when he left, and why they spent so much to bring him in. He or Mata will drop out of the side when they play a Spurs, a Liverpool, a Arsenal,
see like Herrera,
a Manchester City. You'll see Herrera or Fellaini come in. And it will be more of a, I think, a sort of 4-1-4-1, where I think in that scenario, Matic will become much more of a holder, and Herrera and Pogba, or Fellaini and Pogba, will be sort of advanced players to try and disrupt the deep playmaker. So against Manchester City, they're going to want to get around Yaya Toure, Fernandinho, Silva when he withdraws, De Bruyne when he withdraws, and leave one sort of steely holder, which will be Matic. So their strategy is going to change entirely, which, I'm not a fan of it, but I respect that. What I don't respect is having that strategy against teams that you're much better than. You know, you should dominate like they did against West Ham.
We want to see them go for it in games like this.
So let's move that on to our last team, our last topic, Liverpool. Oh, man. So that's two predictions in a row that don't look great for me. Because not only did I say Manchester United won't be in a title race, even though I hope they will, because a Jose Mourinho, Pep Guardiola title race is what we're all hoping for and what just makes you salivate. I said Liverpool, if they could keep Coutinho and fix their defensive issues and maybe pick up Van Dijk or another defensive option, would be in a title race. Not only does it look unlikely they're going to be keeping Coutinho, although I still think they will, they did not fix the defensive issues in the offseason. And here we go again with another talented Liverpool side, another manager that can't figure it out defensively. This is, by the way, the sword that Brendan Rodgers fell on. This was the stick that everyone beat him with. The high-scoring, free-flowing, entertaining Liverpool that came within a Steven Gerrard slip of winning the title, that beautiful, romantic season that all crumbled right on the final home stretch. Everyone basically, as they did the autopsy of that season, looked at defensive issues as the reason that they couldn't win the title. And that, I think, exclusively is why Brendan Rodgers lost his job at Liverpool. It's happening again. It's happening again under Jurgen Klopp. Set pieces. The easiest thing in the game, not to do, defending set pieces is really difficult, but to work on. And it doesn't, I mean, from what they did and how they defended those set pieces, it doesn't look like they figured out anything in the offseason. It's remarkable. Players without a finger on them jumping for balls in the box and finishing chances. and second and third opportunities to clear the ball not taken. That's inexcusable. But more than that, through the run of play, again, they look dynamite going forward. That combination, Mane dummies the ball, Emre Can, one touch to him, Mane buries it far post. I think that made it 1-1. That was the response to going down 1-0. Was that the first goal?
Yeah. Mane goal was the first one, yep.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, okay, you said to yourself, okay, defensive lapse, hopefully that woke them up. Here comes Liverpool. They figured it out. They had to have worked on it in the offseason. It doesn't look like they worked on it in the offseason at all. You know, just vulnerable in transition. Center back's not communicating. Moreno. And Liverpool fans are going to tear their hair out about this guy. They got Robertson in the offseason. They have a left back. So Milner actually played midfield, didn't start there, but came on for the first time in over a season in the Premier League. So it looked like, okay, you know, if they're going to go with Moreno, Jurgen Klopp said he's got a great preseason and he's almost like a new signing. Now that looked like the Moreno that we remember, making a terrible challenge, leaving all this space behind him that cleverly ran into for the goal. So I've been big on the Coutinho thing. I honestly do believe Coutinho is integral to a top four challenge or a title race challenge. If they want to be involved in either of those, they have to keep Coutinho. But if they don't fix the defensive issues, just sell him. If you can't figure out the defensive issues, sell him for £120 million. That's a huge influx of capital. That's a lot of money to strengthen the squad and hopefully give you enough depth to continue to try to chip away at the top six and be a consistent top four team and maybe kick the can down the road for a title race. But what's going on? What's going on?
It's hard to figure out.
It's first game of the season, so we'll pump the brakes a bit, but this is kind of like my Arsenal gripes. Yeah, it's first game of the season. I remember some of the complaints I was making on the commentary at Emirates. You know, Arsenal fans, of course, as they always do, I love you, Gooners, are all over me about it's the first game of the season, just relax, Martino. No, it's not. It's been 10 years of that. And with Liverpool, no, it's been 3 or 4 years of this. So don't give me the first game of the season stuff. This is a thread. This is a linear story that links to issues that we see perpetuate.
The thing too is, you know, defenders like Matip and Lovren. You know, when Lovren was at Southampton and Liverpool acquired him, he was one of the most sought after defenders. And so, how is he great at Southampton, and when he comes to Liverpool, not anymore?
And it wasn't Jose Font. I mean, Font, mm-hmm. I mean, wasn't excellent when he left. So there was something about the two of them and Pochettino and being organized and working on that stuff.
So, I mean, it just makes me wonder, even let's say they do find a way to bring in Van Dijk. Are we going to see Van Dijk start to struggle again? Is there a bigger issue in terms of how Klopp sets his team up, how, like you mentioned, how he trains, prepares for set pieces or just their shape system, you know, whatever. I just wonder, I don't want to say he's overrated, Klopp, but I wonder if there's a bigger issue here in the way that this team is being set up.
So I think you're absolutely right. I said it when we were over in England, getting Van Dijk doesn't solve this problem. I mean, does it make you better? Yeah. And does it maybe mitigate some of the defensive issues? Yeah. But not enough to be in a title race. You know, Henderson as a holder, as much as I think he's really good in this role and he's found it and figured it out, because it's not a role he's trained at. It's not a role he's been playing for his Premier League career. It's something he's embraced recently and been asked to be that lone holder, whether for club or country. That's not a role he's really been groomed for a long time, but I think he's embraced it and done it well. But sometimes he struggles with discipline and being the guy in there that can shield the back line enough to be a lone holder and not need an Emre Can or Wijnaldum next to him. So if you don't have an excellent back line that's organized, disciplined, dominant, that's going to be exposed that Henderson hasn't worked at that his entire career. So, yeah, I think if they sign Van Dijk, they're better, but that doesn't solve the problem. And you said Klopp. Does this mean Klopp is overrated? No, it doesn't mean he's overrated. What he did at Borussia Dortmund wasn't a fluke. You know, he took a team that was in 13th, got them to 6th, 5th, and won 2 titles in a row against the most dominant team up there with Real Madrid and Barcelona in the game of soccer. I mean, Bayern Munich is a powerhouse unlike anything in the Premier League right now. They are a powerhouse unlike Manchester City, unlike Chelsea, and Klopp got the better of them 2 seasons in a row. So he is,
almost beat them in the Champions League final. That went down to the
final. So he's the real deal, right? I mean, he's the real deal, but he's looking like there is a defensive organization blind spot that he needs to get right.
And you think it's bigger than just the defense, though? You said you were just kind of hinting at midfield. They were unable to also get Naby Keita, another one. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, we've heard rumors of Chelsea going after Danny Drinkwater. Do we need to start hearing more rumors of that with Liverpool, that they need to bring in a midfield that's going to help, like you said, for Henderson, so he doesn't feel so exposed or get so exposed in those situations?
Yeah.
That's another area that needs to
address. Yeah, because if it's not Henderson, who is it? It's Emre Can. I mean, Emre Can's the exact same thing.
They let Lucas go. Maybe they could actually use him.
Emre Can's the exact same thing. I mean, he whether for German full team, German youth team, Liverpool, has been asked to play multiple roles. He's played center back. He's played outside back. He's played outside mid. He's played center mid. He's a center midfielder. But he's not been asked to be a holding defensive midfielder consistently for club or country. So that's a learning curve for him as well. So either tactically or personnel-wise, but basically both, something needs to happen, and something needs to happen pretty quickly with Liverpool if they have any ambition, any belief that they can be a part of a title race.
Just real quick, Jordan Henderson had some quotes about Coutinho. He's asked about Coutinho.
Yeah.
He's been kind of getting mixed reviews. He basically said, "It's a difficult situation for Phil. Whatever I say won't help matters. We want Phil to stay because he's a world-class player. Ask anybody in the team, they want him to stay. I don't think I can influence the situation," which is kind of the key bite there. And the reason it's sort of been being criticized is there when you brought this up in the podcast last week, when they were able to convince Suarez to stay an extra year in 2013 instead of going to Arsenal, it's come out now that Gerrard was instrumental in
keeping
Suarez
there.
And again, because he's wearing the captain's armband now, Jordan Henderson's always going to have this comparison to Gerrard, and they play a similar position. Is it a little unfair to say that this is Jordan Henderson needs to do more to get Coutinho? Because also, it's a little bit different. It was Arsenal trying to get Suarez, not Barcelona trying to get Coutinho.
And the money was twice.
Yes.
I mean, we were talking about 40 or 50 million pounds for Suarez. I mean, we're talking about 100, 120 million pounds for Coutinho. So there are similarities. And I referenced that in the podcast last time and on the broadcast. They've done this once. They kept the star. They kept Barcelona at bay, you know, and Arsenal's hilarious 40 million plus £1 bid that got John W. Henry to tweet out, "What are they smoking over at the Emirates?" So they've been able to keep a star once and almost won the title the next season. I think they can do it again, even though the money's twice what it was then, even though they don't have a Steven Gerrard. And to answer your question, it is unfair to think that Jordan Henderson's responsibility is to convince Coutinho. If anyone's going to convince Coutinho to stay, it's Firmino. What I worry about is not only if Coutinho leaves, what they lose in his ability and what he brings on the field. I worry about Firmino because he becomes their next best player and their next most important player. That's one of his best friends. I'll tell you, losing a best friend on a team or losing someone you have great chemistry with, that hurts your performances individually as well. So that's another issue they have to worry about. So my Liverpool for the title prediction, I didn't say they were going to win the title, but I think I said they'd be in a title race, is looking not so good right now. Not so good. So those are the three topics for today. Because there's so many topics, I think we should do something that we're going to continue throughout the Tadpod this season.
It was just too crazy an opening weekend.
Too crazy.
It's only limited to
three.
It's like
trying to pick your favorite kid. You know, you can't. You can't. So let's add one more topic, and we're going to do that this year. When there's too many topics and we're leaving one out, we're going to call it an extra time topic. So the extra time topic for the Tadpod this week, the Gunners, Arsenal. Because I was asked this after the weekend, what was my favorite moment, what was my favorite game? And although Manchester United was the most dominant and the best performance of the weekend, the best moment was at the Emirates. I was there on the gantry, and I think I said it on the commentary, when Giroud came on and scored that goal, the Emirates was absolutely shaking. I mean, it was one of the most passionate and just amazing sporting moments I've witnessed. And I know, you know, it's a last minute winning goal, first game of the season against a mid table team. In the grand scheme of things, it shouldn't mean that much, but it felt like it did. And that's the point. The point is, there was a roller coaster of emotions, PJ, in that game. I had a couple Arsenal fans behind me, and I think Arlo apologized for it on the broadcast, saying some things in like the first 10 minutes that can't be repeated about Mesut Ozil, about the team, about Arsene Wenger. I mean, there was vitriol being spewed all around the Emirates, and let me just say, it wasn't by the majority of fans, and there's a lot of Gunners that are probably listening right now or on Twitter that I'll say what you're thinking or what you're probably screaming at your car stereo right now or your iPhone right now. You don't think that way. You don't say those things. And the majority of Arsenal fans are behind this team, behind this manager. But that place for a while there, I mean, there was a stretch of that game where Leicester were pummeling them. Arsenal couldn't string two or three passes together. Xhaka was giving the ball away cheaply. Leicester looked like title-winning Leicester, and Arsenal looked like capitulation February, January Arsenal. So there was a moment there, and it wasn't a short moment. It wasn't just a moment in time. It was like a 20 or 30-minute stretch where Arsenal fans were already saying, here we go again. So the fact that Arsene Wenger changed things tactically, moved to a back four, brought on Olivier Giroud, did what he needed to do to claw the game back, brought in Aaron Ramsey, and every single one of those moves worked. Ramsey gets a goal. Giroud gets the winner. That not only said so much about the spirit of Arsenal. I mean, don't forget, they've been terrible in opening games for the last nine seasons. So this was going to be more than just a game. This wasn't going to be the first game of the season. It was going to be a continuation game. And the fact that they showed the spirit, the determination, the tactical nous, the personnel to claw back into that game said a lot. Said a lot about the spirit of this group, said a lot about Arsene Wenger, and was a remarkably important moment for their season because it could have easily turned into the biggest storyline of the weekend, the biggest headline, and the team with the most disgruntled fans after game one, and it went the opposite.
Yeah. I mean, some other positives I think to bring up is Lacazette scoring 90 seconds in his debut. I mean, that you can't ask for a better start than that for him. And then Welbeck gets a goal, and I think you guys all agreed.
Kolasinac looks
pretty good.
Oh my god, he looks terrifying
in his debut too. So there's a lot of positives, obviously, to take away.
Well, the other positive to take away is, think about what was missing from that back line. Now, they got torn apart. The back three didn't work for myriad reasons. One being Monreal playing the center of a back three, something he hasn't been asked to do a lot and something he's not comfortable with. They were so susceptible to service into the box, something that we said over the broadcast before they conceded a goal. They were missing Koscielny and even Mertesacker, who has been phased out or you know, not used as much, but was the best performer at Wembley in the FA Cup win.
He's coming off that head injury in the Community Shield.
So yeah, Mustafi was there. He just didn't start, which was a head scratcher because he would have performed better in that center position. I think they were a bit concerned about the pace of Vardy over the top, which is probably why they played Monreal over Mustafi. But that was an important game for Arsenal. It does not paper over the fact that they needed a late heroic run. And I said this over the broadcast, that game basically perfectly encapsulated and was like a condensed version of a Arsenal season. Start off the first part of the campaign pretty well, play a couple of months where you look like the best team in the Premier League, have a terrible middle of the campaign where it looks like you might not finish mid-table, and then have this remarkable finish to the end of the season where you power on to a top-four finish. I mean, that's what that game looked like in a condensed version. And so I do think there's a lot of positives to take out of it because that finish, winning a game like that, for me, is better than having a silky, easy 1-0 performance against Leicester that wouldn't have answered a lot of questions and is something they're more than capable of at the Emirates. That was a good performance to say, listen, okay, there's issues. Let's not kid ourselves. We have defensive issues that we're working on, that we improved at the end of last year switching to a back three. We need to remember that it's easy to slip back into being bad on set pieces, being bad in transition, being sloppy sometimes when we're not switched on. But if they can nip those in the bud, the spirit that they showed, keep that. Bottle that up. You need that in January, February. You need that fight. You need that belief. They also need Olivier Giroud. As much as Arsenal fans always crap on this guy, he gets it done for them. Now, Lacazette, I think, is first option because he brings a bit more. He's pacing behind. He can play with his back to the goal. He got thrown off the ball several times, which is the downside with him. But he can play off the left. He gives them a lot. But Giroud, when he's not a starter, is a super sub, is the best super sub in the Premier League. And they need to keep him, and it looks like they're going to. Arsene Wenger has said, Olivier Giroud have said, not going to Everton, not leaving. He wants to stay. The other guy they got to keep, but it looks like they might not. And I just penny for his thoughts after that first game. We showed him on camera a couple times, and you know he didn't really show a lot of emotion, not a lot you can read with his facial expression. Alexis, still linked with Manchester City. We'll be shocked and awed if they let that happen. I don't care what the dollar amount is. They can't let him go to a rival. That would be worse than the Matic situation. But what happens with Alexis?
I wanted to actually ask you about him because you had the opportunity to call this match, like you said. So what was your takeaway how they looked in it? I mean, they obviously had four goals. Did it look like a team that can survive without Alexis in attack? Or did you still feel there was something missing there?
Listen, Alexis was their most important player and is their most productive player. So losing him will be a big blow. If there's any team that can handle losing their star player in that role, it's Arsenal because of the depth they have in that position. Whether it be Welbeck, whether it be Lacazette playing out there, whether it be Iwobi, I mean, Walcott, Oxlade, I mean, go down the list. I mean, that's the thing they've been doing. While they've failed to go and sign defensive midfielders or someone capable, a Matic, a N'Golo Kante, Bakayoko. I mean, we could go down the list of defensive players that would have been perfect to slot right into that midfield for Arsenal. They have been compiling remarkable, talented, attacking center to winger midfield options. So they're deep there, at least.
So you don't think they'd have to go and make a – if they do let him go, that they'd have to try and bring someone else in? You think they'd be fine with all the depth they have? Not fine.
They should. They absolutely should. I'm not – it won't be as devastating as losing Coutinho would be for Liverpool. So, wow. Crazy, crazy, crazy opening weekend. So much fun. We're off to a thriller here. We couldn't have asked for a better start. So let's just hope it all continues, and I'm sure it will. The drama in the Premier League never fails to be present, never fails to entertain. You know, it was an amazing, positive, remarkable weekend, but I just want to take a moment and talk about something that happened over the weekend that we actually spoke about on our podcast that was a terrible, negative, and just heartbreaking part of the weekend, and that's what happened in Charlottesville. Charlottesville is important to me. I went to the University of Virginia, and, you know, being located in Charlottesville, I got to spend two of the best years of my life in that town, meet people, see the beautiful sights, eat at the beautiful restaurants, walk the mall area, go to the corner, and just enjoy life in a really beautiful town filled with beautiful people. And what happened this past weekend in Charlottesville is the antithesis to that. It was hate. It was violence. It was everything that Charlottesville isn't. And, you know, first and most importantly, I'm a parent and I have a daughter. And I just had tears in my eyes when I found out that there's a parent out there that no longer has their daughter. There are parents out there that had to get the news that they lost their daughter senselessly to these abhorrent and awful people that organized to go to a town full of love, full of support, full of unity to spread hate and discrimination and bigotry. And there's just no place for it in any town, in any part of the world. And I can't believe that there is a broken heart out there right now trying to make sense of why their daughter's no longer there. And her name's Heather Hare. I think that's how you pronounce it, and I'm sorry if I mispronounced it. But she went to where it was all happening to stand up. She went to be brave, to show courage, and to stand up for love and for unity and for equality. And it cost her life. And we all have to remember that there are people out there that stand up, and we have to remember her name and say it out loud and thank her for standing up and doing what's right. And, you know, she's just an inspiration to all of us who who want more for this world than what we saw in Charlottesville this past weekend. So I can't say enough how heartbroken I am for her family. And, I have it on my Twitter feed, and it says, if you've seen my profile, not sticking to sports since 1981, just because we're athletes, just because we get paid to be on the radio or be on television and talk about a game, doesn't mean we can't be humans first. And, there's a lot of Tad Potters out here that are on here that disagree with me on many things, and I invite you to disagree with me. Discourse is important. It's an important part of democracy. It's an important part of life. And soccer unites us all. A love for that brings us all together and allows us all to smile, laugh, and enjoy each weekend we get watching this amazing league and watching this beautiful game. But I think it's important for us all from time to time to unite behind another cause. And this cause is equality, is tolerance, is acceptance, is beauty, is love. And let's just all unite with that. Let's all get together. And I finish every Tad Pod with a little saying, and it's stay on your feet, a bit of a tongue-in-cheek way to finish the podcast based on it being called That's a Dive. But let me just finish this Tad Pod this week with stand up. Thanks, Tad Potters.